يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. 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 الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله كبير، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. كبير، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله يا كبير يا متكبر، الله أكبر. بسم الله بسم الله بسم الله. So we begin the, our next session of on inner life with this new approach, which I am trying out this time, and hopefully we'll receive your feedback on that as well, how it goes. So I am hoping today to cover the whole chapter of chapter 5, which is freedom of action. So I will be doing a little bit of reading and then some sort of just contemplation, and we'll see how we go on. So I start with that little bit of reading. It's just sort of like bringing together the whole chapter, you know, just some of the most, some of the kind of paragraphs that stand out the most. The whole paragraph, the whole chapter is about how we progress through life, you know, like children grow up. And when children are small, then they need lots of rules in order to keep them safe and in order to teach them. And then as they grow up, they can start relying more on their own wisdom and experience. And so the inner life is the same, in the same way, that at first we, when we don't have so much experience, we need to kind of take the external kind of laws, or you know, we need to live by those. And then the more our inner life awakens, the more we become masters of ourselves, you know. So that's like the in a nutshell. Now just a couple of paragraphs here. Gataka. As we grow through the inner life, so we feel a freedom of thought, speech, and action, which comes as a natural course through our spiritual journey. And the reason why this freedom comes and whence it comes can be explained by the fact that there is a spirit of freedom hidden within us, covered by outward conventionalities. So it's kind of it's saying that that the freedom is not something that we acquire from somewhere outside. Somebody outside sets us free, but it's an unfolding from within. So then, something that Murshid Sam is saying. He's saying Sufis have been divided into those that follow Shariat and those who do not. Shariat is the outer law of Islam or Sufism. But Sufism without the divine experience is nothing. And all Sufis agree on this point. Not only Al-Ghazali, but all of them. And no man is free until he can establish his own laws, not his own wild freedom. The customs of the dervishes are such that even those who seem anarchistic are working for the benefit of all mankind. They do not have bodhisattvic vows. They do not need these as vows. This is the way of their life. So here the it's just the Sufism without the divine experience is nothing. So, and also that no one is free until they can establish their own laws, not their own wild freedom. So it's that we don't, you know, the spiritual liberty is not just doing whatever we want. Because the true freedom, you know, once you have that insight or the inner life active, then there will be actually many more inner rules, you could say, or inner laws that you are governed by or that you are living your life by. And these are not kind of put upon you by anybody from outside. It is the living according to nature, basically. And And this is the goal really for us, to live according to nature. And it is freedom, and yet it is not just doing whatever we want. Then another one, Gatheka. For this reason, Jesus Christ has said, judge not. But this teaching has been given to point out that judge not applies to your equal. For the one who is still more advanced, no one can judge. When we have the tendency to judge one more advanced than ourselves, the consequence is that spiritual advancement deteriorates. Because however advanced we may be, those who have not yet advanced pull us down. Therefore, humanity, instead of going forward, goes backward. And here, both Hazrat Inayat Khan and Murshid Sam are then bringing in different examples and stories, from history. Like, for example, starting with Socrates, who actually who died, I think it's established that on 15th of February, lots and lots of years ago. So it's kind of like last week or something like that. And he was accused of corrupting the youth and leading people away from God's. But really, what he was doing, he was questioning everything. And he went to this, there is a story that he went to this prophetess and asked, like, is there someone else who is more knowledgeable than I am? And the prophetess said, no, there is nobody who is more knowledgeable than you are. And then Socrates was not happy with that answer and went in search of, to find somebody who would be, more knowledgeable than him. And he was asking all sorts of people. And what he realized was that, was that those who thought they were more knowledgeable were actually less fortunate than him because they didn't know how much they didn't know. That he knew that he didn't know, and therefore that knowledge was more than those people who thought they knew but actually didn't know. So he kept kind of exploring and inquiring and asking questions, and politically this didn't fit very well with the sort of aristocrats and with the ruling classes, and then he was because young people, some of the young people were drawn to his inquisitive ways and were sort of following in his footsteps and asking questions, and that's why he was accused of corrupting the youth. And then he was sentenced to death by drinking poison of hemlock drink. But he didn't, he took it very stoically and very kind of calmly and like that. However, how it relates to this here is that this sentence here, when man has the tendency to judge one more advanced than himself, the consequence is that spiritual advancement deteriorates. So after Socrates died, then the whole culture started to collapse, and there was a there was a deterioration in the whole societal kind of order. And similarly with others, other stories, there is a story of what's his name now? I think it was, oh yes, Mansur al-Hallaj, which you might have heard of, that he was exclaiming that Ina al-Haq, I am the truth. And he was sentenced to death brutally, publicly by that, because again the so to speak the conventional reality or the ruling people who were creating the laws, they saw it as him proclaiming that he was God, whereas Sufi saw this as him totally renouncing his nafs, his ego, and so that there was only God left who was speaking. So there was a totally different way to understand the same thing, but he was then condemned to death for that. And after that, the whole empire collapsed. So there's interesting parallels like that in history, where when people who don't have such great understanding judge the ones who are more advanced, then it brings about a collapse or deterioration or a kind of things going backward. So just one more little thing from Guy and from Hazrat Inayat Khan's sayings. He says, "Master is he only who is master of himself. Ruler is he only who is ruler of himself." So that brings us back to again talking about what is mastery? What does it mean to rule ourselves? What does it mean to be ruler of ourselves? And this is what this chapter is focusing on quite a bit, talking about that there are these different aspects that make us or that bring mastery to us, that help us to achieve mastery. And one is this that we are not governed by the outer laws, that we make our own laws, our internal laws. Then it is that we have this evolution or maturity, which is that we understand that there is a need for social laws, because without those, there would be a lot of confusion and chaos in the world. It's like if the children do not have any laws, they need some laws in order to help them to grow up. So there are some laws that are necessary in the world, and yet we're not bound by those, or the master is not bound by those. They respect them, but they are not limited by those. Then the higher morals, that comes back to the first one, which is that we have our own inner laws, which are actually requiring a lot of discipline and requiring quite a lot more of awareness. than the common laws. And then there is oneness with causation, which is basically what the Zen masters are talking about. You know, that when a Zen monk was asked, you know, are you what's the I need to find it now. One moment. I can't find it. So, but it's basically that that we are we are not differentiating, we are not judging, and our actions are not driven by the ego self. So they come from that sense, that place of oneness. Okay. So let's do a practice. So we're gonna use two wazifas here, two wazifas for wisdom. So we are invoking wisdom in all ways, and you know, the wisdom that is discerning wisdom, which is clear-headed and subtle and intelligent, and it is us seeing by the means of God or through the. It's like us seeing through the eyes of of our heart. And there is a hadith which says, "Be aware of the penetrating insight of the believer, because such a one sees by the light of God." Be aware of the penetrating insight of the believer, because such a one sees by the light of God. So this is so the wazifa is Ya Hakam. Ya Hakam. Ya Hakam, which is the discerning wisdom. And it helps us to reflect on the secrets of the divine essence. And to live actively according to this according to our reflections. And it is the time that we can take to clear our senses that may be overwhelmed or exhausted or overstimulated, and just allowing that divine wisdom, this discerning wisdom, to guide us. And then the other one is Ya Hakim. Ya Hakim, which is related, loosely related to Ya Hak, that you all know from the dances or from some of the dances. Ya Hakim is the healing wisdom. It is the wisdom that becomes our medicine. So Ya Hakim is really the physician of the heart, and it helps us when we are getting lost in the generalities of life, and when we find difficult to translate the knowledge into practical wisdom. It helps us to guide those parts of ourselves, our ego, that are have not quite yet the maturity of being one with God. So we are invoking these two sides of wisdom, Ya Hakam and Ya Hakim. Ya Hakam, Ya Hakim. Ya Hakam, Yahakim. Yahakam. 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 Yahakim. We carry on the breath, breathing in Yahakam, breathing out Yahakim. Breathing in the discerning wisdom, breathing out the healing wisdom, allowing it to go to the places inside where it's needed. Letting go of the words and just breathing with the feeling that you have just now. So instead of judging others, we can cultivate that sense of inner sight or insight or kasv in Sufi terms, that helps us to not criticize, not tear down or put down others, but instead elevating others. So that's the practice, instead of judging and criticizing, to elevate others. So we can take that into our life and see how we get on with that. Tasawwuf. Muhammad himself said, "Let there be no compulsion in Islam." And then Tasawwuf again. Making rules is a proof of lack of pure faith. Making rules is a proof of lack of pure faith. So we are still talking about all these different ways or different stories where people get, more advanced beings get judged and criticized by those who do not know or don't have the insight. Kateka. Those who rise above the ordinary conventionalities of life by their inner development come to another consciousness. For them, worldly laws are the laws for the children. Those who begin to see this difference between the laws they set before themselves and the laws that are observed by humankind, at first sometimes condemn and then disregard the common laws. They criticize them and ask, "What is it all for?" But for those who come to the fuller realization of the inner laws, they show respect even for the laws of children, knowing that they are the laws for children and not for the grown-up. Yet they respect them, for they know that it cannot be otherwise. The laws which they know can only manifest to the one whose soul rises to that realization. But before the soul rises, it must have some law by which to live in harmony. Therefore, advanced souls regard such laws with respect and observe them when they are in the community. So this is an interesting one, because it's, I guess there is always this potential conflict or dilemma about, the laws that are unjust or that we do not agree with, that we see that need to be changed. And then at the same time, going with what Hazrat Inayat Khan is invoking and asking us to do here, to respect the laws of the children, so to speak. So how do we hold those two? How do we hold those two in our life? And, from the Sufi perspective, it is important to preserve harmony. We are saying toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony and beauty. So the law of harmony is comes in here, which is a very important aspect. And at the same time, even though we respect that these are the laws, there is still room for our own wisdom to guide us, you know. And you know, so this is like, there is another Sufi saint, Sarmad, who was reportedly, you know, who had the ability to see into the minds of others and see what others what was going on in their minds. And he was living in constant prayer. Every breath, every thought, everything for him was prayer. But at that time, there was a law that everybody had to go to the mosque and pray at the particular times and listen to the prayers of imams. He could see into the minds of imams and could see that they were just reciting the prayers without meaning, without knowing really what they were saying, or without fully being, you know, in their prayer. They, you know, basically they were hypocrites. And so he did not go to the he didn't go to the mosque. And then when the emperor called him and said, "Hey, you know, you are required to go to the mosque and to pray. It is the law." Then he was kind of saying that, "Oh, I just forgot. I forgot." So, so he was, yeah, having his own way with this. You know, he just. He accepted that this was the law, and at the same time, he could not bring himself to do that, to go and do something meaningless, whereas every breath for him was the prayer already. Anyway, he was also executed and beheaded for his non-obedience. And then the empire fell apart because the awareness, the human awareness, deteriorated. The social kind of order, you know, it all deteriorated because the laws of the more highly advanced being were not taken into account. They were criticized. So, you know, yet another story like that. So, on the other hand, though, respecting the laws of those who are maybe not as involved, you know, the laws of the children, you could say, it kind of teaches us humility. It's kind of going back to the Socrates and his thing, you know, "I know I don't know." So how much do we know, actually know, and how much do we know of others? So it's maybe something to contemplate. Jesus Christ said, "I come not to destroy, but to fulfill the law." I come not to destroy, but to fulfill the law. So he is talking again about this, the higher law, not the children's law. And because he was talking about the higher law, and that's what he was doing in his life, he got crucified. Kateka. Now the question is, do those who are spiritually advanced have any special conception of morals? Indeed they have. And their morals are great morals, much greater than the average human being can conceive. It is not that by becoming free spiritually from the laws of the generality, they become free from their own laws. They have their own laws to bind them, and these are much higher and much greater laws. No doubt, their way of looking at things may be criticized and may not be generally understood. Yet their law is more akin to nature. Their laws are in harmony with the spirit. Their laws have their effect as phenomena. And by regarding two morals which are contrary to each other, the morals of the generality and their own morals, they arrive at a plane and a condition where their hands and feet are nailed. That is the symbolical meaning of the nailing of Christ to the cross. So this is the ultimate sacrifice and also at the same time the perspective of a Sufi, you know, to live in the world but not be, to be of the world, which is in the same way we are being kind of stretched by these laws of humankind, and at the same time we also see or we seek to see the divine laws, or which nail us to the cross. It's difficult. It's not easy. It's, you know, it's, yeah, that's our path. That's our path. And yet, by living that, if we can truly live that, we elevate the whole humankind. For example, Rumi, who was also a very sort of anarchistic practitioner, you could say, anarchistic Sufi. However, because at that time in Turkey, his wisdom was appreciated, and there was lots of sultans who came for him to, for initiation, and you know, or higher powers of the country came to him for teachings. Then Turkey became very, you know, like it started to blossom as a country. The culture really evolved, and it became the country flourished. Until you know, these higher teachings started to be kind of put down, and that's when the downfall came again. So what is our work here? as we are journeying on this path of Sufism, you know, our, you could say, one of our jobs is to accept the cross that we are carrying. And you know, by, you know, not judging, you know, the, sort of giving up our right to judge others, and by that living by our own inner laws, and therefore sort of we don't allow our ego to get the upper hand and to start tearing us down, and we give a chance for all of humankind to evolve. So we'll do one more practice now. It's one where we invoke the omniscient knowledge of God, and knowing that this divine divine knowledge, divine presence is infinitely and always embracing us. So we use the again a pair of wazifa. First one is Ya Alim, Ya Alim, Ya Alim, which is the omniscient knowledge of God. It is the it includes all the inner knowledge, outer knowledge, the seen and unseen, you know, all the knowledge that there is, and it reaches everything without exception. And it's the knowledge of the secret heart, secret essence of our heart. And then the second one is Yawasi. 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 And this is the infinite, all-embracing presence of the divine. So there is a hadith that says, wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. And so this presence is all-embracing, but not limiting, not narrowing. It's a kind of opening at the same time. You know, it's like the you know, another hadith that, you know, the heaven and the earth cannot contain me, but the heart of my faithful servant can contain me. So it's that sort of all embracing infinite presence. So we are bringing into our being this infinite knowledge of God that is all embracing, always present, that is reaching every single thing, every single place inside of us and outside of us. So we are just invoking, bringing these qualities to our being, to our life, to guide and support us, and to help to break us through the habitual boundaries of the mind, and to open the door to our heart. Ya Alim, Ya Wasi, 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 Ya Alim, Yawasya. Ya'alim. Yawasya. Ya'alim. Yawasya. Ya'alim. Yawasya. Ya'alim. Yawasya. Ya'alim. Yawasya. Ya Alim, Ya Wasya, Ya Alim, Ya Wasya, Ya Alim, Ya Wasya, Ya Alim, Ya Wasya, Ya Alim, Ya Wasya. Ya Alim, Ya Wasya. Breathing in, Alim. Breathing out, Ya Wasya. And then letting go of the words. Feeling that infinite presence, infinite knowledge of the One taking root inside of us.